Instead of raising it, thought he, they have lowered it, and he sprang from the rock in order to inspect the base on which it had formerly stood. He soon perceived that a slope had been formed, and the rock had slid along this until it stopped at the spot it now occupied. A large stone had served as a wedge. Flints and pebbles had been inserted around it, so as to conceal the orifice. This species of masonry had been covered with earth, and grass and weeds had grown there. Moss had clung to the stones, myrtle bushes had taken root, and the old rock seemed fixed to the earth. Dantès raised the earth carefully, and detected, or fancied he detected, the ingenious artifice. He attacked this wall, cemented by the hand of time with his pickaxe. After 10 minutes' labor, the wall gave way, and a hole, large enough to insert the arm, was opened. Dantès went and cut the strongest olive tree he could find, stripped off its branches, inserted it in the hole, and used it as a lever. But the rock was too heavy and too firmly wedged to be moved by any one man, were he Hercules himself. Dantès reflected that he must attack this wedge, but how? He cast his eyes around and saw the horn full of powder which his friend Jacopo had left him. He smiled. The infernal invention would serve him for this purpose. With the aid of his pickaxe, Dantès dug between the upper rock and the one that supported it a mine similar to those formed by pioneers when they wished to spare human labor, filled it with powder, then made a match by rolling his handkerchief in saltpeter. He lighted it and retired. The explosion was instantaneous. The upper rock was lifted from its base by the terrific force of the powder. The lower one flew into pieces. Thousands of insects escaped from the aperture Dantès had previously formed, and a huge snake, like the guardian demon of the treasure, rolled himself along with a sinuous motion and disappeared. Dantès approached the upper rock, which now, without any support, leant towards the sea. The intrepid treasure-seeker walked round it, and selecting the spot from whence it appeared most easy to attack it, placed his lever in one of the crevices and strained every nerve to move the mass. The rock, already shaken by the explosion, tottered on its base. Dantès redoubled his efforts. He seemed like one of the ancient titans who uprooted the mountains to hurl against the father of the gods. The rock yielded, rolled, bounded, and finally disappeared in the ocean. On the spot it had occupied was visible a circular place, and which exposed an iron ring let into a square flagstone. Dantès uttered a cry of joy and surprise. Never had a first attempt been crowned with more perfect success. He would fain have continued, but his knees trembled, his heart beat so violently, and his eyes became so dim that he was forced to pause. This feeling lasted but for a moment. Edmund inserted his lever in the ring, and exerting all his strength, the flagstone yielded and disclosed a kind of stair that descended until it was lost in the obscurity of a subterraneous grotto. Anyone else would have rushed on with a cry of joy. Dantès turned pale, hesitated, and reflected. "Come," said he to himself, "be a man. I am accustomed to adversity. I must not be cast down by the discovery that I have been deceived. What then would be the use of all I have suffered? The heart breaks when, after having been elated by flattering hopes, it sees all these illusions destroyed. Faria has dreamed this. The Cardinal Spada buried no treasures here. Perhaps he never came here, or if he did, Cesar Borgia, the intrepid adventurer, the stealthy and indefatigable plunderer, has followed him, discovered his traces, pursued them as I have done, like me, raised the stone, and descending before me, has left me nothing." He remained motionless and pensive, his eyes fixed on the somber aperture that was open at his feet. "Now that I expect nothing, now that I no longer entertain the slightest hopes, the end of this adventure becomes a simple matter of curiosity." And he remained again, motionless and thoughtful. "Yes. Yes, this is an adventure worthy of a place in the lights and shades of the life of this royal bandit. this fabulous event has formed but a link in a vast chain. Yes, Borgia has been here, a torch in one hand, a sword in the other, whilst within 20 paces at the foot of this rock, perhaps, two guards kept watch on land and sea, whilst their masters descended, as I am about to descend, dispelling the darkness before his terrible advance. But what was the fate of these guards who thus possessed his secret? Asked Dantès of himself. The fate, replied he, smiling, of those who buried Alaric. Yet, had he come, thought Dantès, he would have found the treasure. And Borgia, he who compared Italy to an artichoke, which he could devour leaf by leaf, knew too well the value of time to waste it in replacing this rock. I will go down. Then he descended, a smile on his lips, and murmuring that last word of human philosophy, perhaps. But instead of the darkness and the thick and mephitic atmosphere he had expected to find, Dantès saw a dim and bluish light, which, as well as the air, entered not merely by the aperture he had just formed, but by the interstices and crevices of the rock which were visible from without, and through which he could distinguish the blue sky and the waving branches of the evergreen oaks and the tendrils of the creepers that grew from the rocks. After having stood a few minutes in the cavern, the atmosphere of which was rather warm than damp, Dante's eye, habituated as it was to darkness, could pierce even to the remotest angles of the cavern, which was of granite that sparkled like diamonds. Alas, said Edmund, smiling, these are the treasures the cardinal has left, and the good abbe, seeing in a dream these glittering walls, has indulged in fallacious hopes. But he called to mind the words of the will which he knew by heart. In the farthest angle of the second opening, said the cardinal's will. He had only found the first grotto. He had now to seek the second. Dantès commenced his search. He reflected that this second grotto must doubtless penetrate deeper into the aisle. He examined the stones and sounded one part of the wall where he fancied the opening existed, masked for precaution's sake. The pickaxe sounded for a moment with a dull sound that covered Dante's forehead with large drops of perspiration. At last it seemed to him that one part of the wall gave forth a more hollow and deeper echo. He eagerly advanced, and with the quickness of perception that no one but a prisoner possesses, saw that it was there, in all probability, the opening must be. However, he, like Cesar Borgia, knew the value of time, and in order to avoid a fruitless toil, he sounded all the other walls with his pickaxe, struck the earth with the butt of his gun, and finding nothing that appeared suspicious, returned to that part of the wall whence issued the consoling sound he had before heard. He again struck it, and with greater force. Then a singular sight presented itself. As he struck the wall, a species of stucco, similar to that used as the ground of arabesques, detached itself and fell to the ground in flakes, exposing a large white stone. The aperture of the rock had been closed with stones, then this stucco had been applied and painted to imitate granite. Dantès struck with the sharp end of his pickaxe, which entered some way between the interstices of the stone. It was there he must dig, but by some strange phenomenon of the human organization, in proportion as the proofs that Faria had not been deceived became stronger, so did his heart give way, and a feeling of discouragement steal over him. This last proof, instead of giving him fresh strength, deprived him of it. The pickaxe descended, or rather fell. He placed it on the ground, passed his hand over his brow, and remounted the stairs, alleging to himself as an excuse a desire to be assured that no one was watching him, but in reality because he felt he was ready to faint. The aisle was deserted, and the sun seemed to cover it with its fiery glance. Afar off, a few small fishing boats studded the bosom of the blue ocean. Dantès had tasted nothing, but he thought not of hunger at such a moment. He hastily swallowed a few drops of rum and again entered the cavern. The pickaxe that had seemed so heavy was now like a feather in his grasp. He seized it and again attacked the wall. After several blows, he perceived that the stones were not cemented, but merely placed one upon the other and covered with stucco. He inserted the point of his pickaxe, and using the handle as a lever, soon saw with joy the stone turn as if on hinges and fall at his feet. He had nothing more to do now, but with the iron tooth of the pickaxe to draw the stones towards him one by one. The first aperture was sufficiently large to enter, but by waiting he could still cling to hope and retard the certainty of deception. At last, after fresh hesitation, Dantès entered the second grotto. The second grotto was lower and more gloomy than the former. The air that could only enter by the newly formed opening had that mephitic smell Dantès was surprised not to find in the first. He waited in order to allow pure air to displace the foul atmosphere, and then entered. At the left of the opening was a dark and deep angle, but to Dante's eyes there was no darkness. He glanced round this second grotto. It was, like the first, empty. The treasure, if it existed, was buried in this corner. The time had at length arrived. 2 feet of earth removed, and Dante's fate would be decided. He advanced towards the angle, and summoning all his resolution, attacked the ground with the pickaxe. At the fifth or sixth blow, the pickaxe struck against an iron substance. Never did funeral knell, never did alarm bell produce a greater effect on the hearer. Had Dantès found nothing, he could not have become more ghastly pale. He again struck his pickaxe into the earth, and encountered the same resistance, but not the same sound. "It is a casket of wood, bound with iron," thought he. At this moment a shadow passed rapidly before the opening. Dantès seized his gun, sprang through the opening, and mounted the stair. A wild goat had passed before the mouth of the cave, and was feeding at a little distance. This would have been a favourable occasion to secure his dinner, but Dantès feared lest the report of his gun should attract attention. He reflected an instant, cut a branch of a resinous tree, lighted it at the fire at which the smugglers had prepared their breakfast, and descended with this torch. He wished to see all. He approached the hole he had formed with the torch, and saw that his pickaxe had in reality struck against iron and wood. He planted his torch in the ground and resumed his labour. In an instant a space 3 feet long by 2 feet broad was cleared, and Dantès could see an oaken coffer bound with cut steel. In the midst of the lid he saw engraved on a silver plate, which was still untarnished, the arms of the Sparta family, viz. A sword, pale, on an oval shield, like all the Italian armorial bearings, and surmounted by a cardinal's hat. Dantès easily recognized them. Faria had so often drawn them for him. There was no longer any doubt the treasure was there. No one would have been at such pains to conceal an empty casket. In an instant he had cleared every obstacle away, and he saw successively the lock placed between two padlocks, and the two handles at each end, all carved as things were carved at that epoch when art rendered the commonest metals precious. Dantès seized the handles and strove to lift the coffer. It was impossible. He sought to open it. Lock and padlock were closed. These faithful guardians seemed unwilling to surrender their trust. Dantès inserted the sharp end of the pickaxe between the coffer and the lid, and pressing with all his force on the handle, burst open the fastenings. The hinges yielded in their turn and fell, still holding in their grasp fragments of the planks. And all was open. A vertigo seized Edmund. He cocked his gun and laid it beside him. He then closed his eyes, as children do, in order to perceive in shining night of their own imagination more stars than are visible in the firmament. Then he reopened them, and stood motionless with amazement. 3 compartments divided the coffer. In the first blazed piles of golden coin. In the second, bars of unpolished gold, which possessed nothing attractive save their value, were ranged. In the third, Edmund grasped handfuls of diamonds, pearls, and rubies, which, as they fell on one another, sounded like hail against glass. After having touched, felt, examined these treasures, Edmund rushed through the caverns like a man seized with frenzy. He leapt on a rock from whence he could behold the sea. He was alone. Alone with these countless, these unheard-of treasures. Was he awake, or was it but a dream? He would fain have gazed upon his gold, and yet he had not strength enough. For an instant he leaned his head in his hands, as if to prevent his senses from leaving him, and then rushed madly about the rocks of Monte Cristo, terrifying the wild goats and scaring the sea fowls with his wild cries and gestures. Then he returned, and still unable to believe the evidence of his senses, rushed into the grotto and found himself before this mine of gold and jewels. This time he fell on his knees, and clasping his hands convulsively, uttered a prayer intelligible to God alone. He soon felt himself calmer and more happy, for now only he began to credit his felicity. He then set himself to work to count his fortune. There were 1,000 ingots of gold, each weighing from 2 to 3 pounds. Then he piled up 25,000 crowns, each worth about 4 pounds sterling of our money, and bearing the effigies of Alexander VI and his predecessors. And he saw that the compartment was not half empty. And he measured 10 double handfuls of precious stones, many of which, mounted by the most famous workmen, were valuable for their execution. Dantès saw the light gradually disappear, and fearing to be surprised in the cavern, left it, his gun in his hand. A piece of biscuit and a small quantity of rum formed his supper, and he snatched a few hours' sleep, lying over the mouth of the cave. It was a night at once joyous and terrible, such as this man of stupendous emotions had already experienced 2 or 3 times in his life. 25. At Marseille again. Daylight, for which Dantès had so eagerly and impatiently waited, again dawned upon the desert shores of Monte Cristo. With the first dawn of day, Dantès resumed his researches. Again he climbed the rocky height he had ascended the previous evening, and strained his view to catch every peculiarity of the landscape. But it wore the same wild, barren aspect when seen by the rays of the morning sun, which it had done when surveyed by the fading glimmer of eve. Returning to the entrance of the cave, he raised the stone that covered it, and descending to the place that contained the treasure, filled his pockets with precious stones, put the box together as well and securely as he could, sprinkled fresh sand over the spot from which it had been taken, and then carefully trod down the ground to give it everywhere a similar appearance. Then, quitting the grotto, he replaced the stone, heaping on it broken masses of rocks and rough fragments of crumbling granite, filling the interstices with earth, into which were skilfully mingled a quantity of rapidly growing plants, such as the wild myrtle and flowering thorn. Then, carefully watering these new plantations, he scrupulously effaced every trace of footmark, leaving the approach to the cavern as savage-looking and untrodden as he had found it. This done, he impatiently awaited the return of his companions. To wait at Monte Cristo for the purpose of watching over the almost incalculable riches that had thus fallen into his possession satisfied not the cravings of his heart, which yearned to return to dwell among mankind and to assume the rank, power, and influence unbounded wealth alone can bestow. On the sixth day, the smugglers returned. From a distance, Dantès recognized the cut and manner of sailing of the young Amelia, and dragging himself with affected difficulty towards the landing-place, he met his companions with an assurance that, although considerably better than when they quitted him, he still suffered acutely from his late accident. He then inquired how they had fared in their trip. To this question the smugglers replied that, although successful in landing their cargo in safety, they had scarcely done so when they received intelligence that a guard ship had just quitted the port of Toulon and was crowding all sail towards them. This obliged them to make all the speed they could to evade the enemy, when they could but lament the absence of Dantès, whose superior skill in the management of a vessel would have availed them so materially. In fact, the chasing vessel had almost overtaken them when, fortunately, night came on and enabled them to double the Cape of Corsica and so elude all further pursuit. Upon the whole, however, the trip had been sufficiently successful to satisfy all concerned, while the crew, and particularly Jacopo, expressed great regrets at Dantès not having been an equal sharer with themselves in the profits, amounting to no less a sum than 50 piastres each. Edmund preserved the most admirable self-command, not suffering the faintest indication of a smile to escape him at the enumeration of all the benefits he would have reaped had he been able to quit the isle. But as the young Amelia had merely come to Monte Cristo to fetch him away, he embarked that same evening and proceeded with the captain to Leghorn. Arrived at Leghorn, he repaired to the house of a Jew, a dealer in precious stones, to whom he disposed of four of his smallest diamonds for 5,000 francs each. Dantès half feared that such valuable jewels in the hands of a poor sailor like himself might excite suspicion. But the cunning purchaser asked no troublesome questions concerning a bargain by which he gained at least 4,000 francs. The following day, Dantès presented Jacopo with an entirely new vessel, accompanying the gift by a donation of 100 piastres, that he might provide himself with a suitable crew and other requisites for his outfit, upon conditions of his going direct to Marseille, for the purpose of inquiring after an old man named Louis Dantès, residing in the Allée des Meilleurs, and also a young female called Mercedes, an inhabitant of the Catalan village. Jacopo could scarcely believe his senses at receiving this munificent present, which Dantès hastened to account for by saying that he had merely been a sailor from whim and a desire to spite his friends, who did not allow him as much money as he liked to spend, but that on his arrival at Leghorn he had come into possession of a large fortune, left him by an uncle whose sole heir he was. The superior education of Dantès gave an air of such extreme probability to this statement that it never once occurred to Jacopo to doubt its accuracy. The term for which Edmund had engaged to serve on board the young Amelia having expired, Dantès took leave of the captain, who at first tried all his powers of persuasion to induce him to remain one of the crew. But having been told the history of the legacy, he ceased to importune him further. The succeeding morning, Jacopo set sail for Marseille, with directions from Dantès to rejoin him at the island of Monte Cristo. Having seen Jacopo fairly out of the harbour, Dantès proceeded to make his final adieus on board the young Amelia. He distributed so liberal a gratuity among her crew as procured him unanimous good wishes and expressions of cordial interest in all that concerned him. To the captain, he promised to write when he had made up his mind as to his future plans. This leave-taking over, Dantès departed for Genoa. At the moment of his arrival, a small yacht was being tried in the bay. This yacht had been built by order of an Englishman, who, having heard that the Genoese excelled all other builders along the shores of the Mediterranean in the construction of fast-sailing vessels, was desirous of possessing a specimen of their skill. The price agreed upon between the Englishman and Genoese builder was 40,000 francs. Dantès, struck with the beauty and capability of the little vessel, applied to its owner to transfer it to him, offering 60,000 francs, upon condition of being allowed to take immediate possession of it. The proposal was too advantageous to be refused, the more so as the person for whom the yacht was intended had gone upon a tour through Switzerland and was not expected back in less than 3 weeks or a month, by which time the builder reckoned upon being able to complete another. A bargain was therefore struck. Dantès led the owner of the yacht to the dwelling of a Jew, retired with the latter individual for a few minutes to a small back parlour, and upon their return the Jew counted out to the shipbuilder the sum of 60,000 francs in bright golden money. The delighted builder then offered his services in providing a suitable crew for the little vessel, but this Dantès declined with many thanks, saying he was accustomed to cruise about quite alone, and his principal pleasure consisted in managing his yacht himself. The only thing the builder could oblige him in would be to contrive a sort of secret closet in the cabin at his bed's head. The closet to contain 3 divisions, so constructed as to be concealed from all but himself. The builder cheerfully undertook the commission, and promised to have these secret places completed by the next day, Dantès furnishing the size and plan upon which he desired they should be arranged. The following day, Dantès sailed with his yacht from the port of Genoa, amid the gaze of an immense crowd drawn together by curiosity to see the rich Spanish nobleman who preferred managing his vessel himself. But their wonder was soon exchanged for admiration at the perfect skill with which Dantès handled the helm, and without quitting it, making his little vessel perform every movement he chose to direct. His bark seemed indeed animated with all but human intelligence, so promptly did it obey the slightest impulse given, and Dantès required but a short trial of his beautiful craft to acknowledge that it was not without truth the Genoese had attained their high reputation in the art of shipbuilding. The spectators followed the little vessel with their eyes so long as it remained visible. They then turned their conjectures upon her probable destination. Some insisted she was making for Corsica, others the Isle of Elba. Bets were offered to any amount that she was bound for Spain, while Africa was positively reported by many persons as her intended course. But no one thought of Monte Cristo. Yet thither it was that Dantès guided his vessel, and at Monte Cristo he arrived at the close of the second day. His bark had proved herself a first-class sailor, and had come the distance from Genoa in 35 hours. Dantès had carefully noted the general appearance of the shore, and instead of landing at the usual place, he dropped anchor in the little creek. The isle was utterly deserted, nor did it seem as though human foot had trodden on it since he quitted it. His treasure was just as he had left it. Early on the following morning, he commenced the removal of his riches, and ere nightfall, the whole of his immense wealth was safely deposited in the secret compartments of his hidden closet. A week passed by. Dantès employed it in manoeuvring his yacht round the island, studying it as a skilful horseman would the animal he destined for some important service, till at the end of that time he was perfectly conversant with its good and bad qualities. The former Dantès proposed to augment, the latter to remedy. Upon the eighth day of his being on the island, he discerned a small vessel crowding all sail towards Monte Cristo. As it neared, he recognized it as the bark he had given to Jacopo. He immediately signaled it. His signal was returned, and in 2 hours afterwards, the bark lay at anchor beside the yacht. A mournful answer awaited each of Edmund's eager inquiries as to the information Jacopo had obtained. Old Dantès was dead, and Mercedes had disappeared. Dantès listened to these melancholy tidings with outward calmness, but leaping lightly ashore, he signified his desire to be quite alone. In a couple of hours, he returned. Two of the men from Jacopo's bark came on board the yacht to assist in navigating it, and he commanded she should be steered direct to Marseille. For his father's death he was in some manner prepared, but how to account for the mysterious disappearance of Mercedes he knew not. Without divulging his secret, Dantès could not give sufficiently clear instructions to an agent. There were, besides, other particulars he was desirous of ascertaining, and those were of a nature he alone could investigate in a manner satisfactory to himself. His looking-glass had assured him during his stay at Leghorn that he ran no risk of recognition, added to which he had now the means of adopting any disguise he thought proper. One fine morning, then, his yacht, followed by the little bark, boldly entered the port of Marseille, and anchored exactly opposite the memorable spot from whence, on the never-to-be-forgotten night of his departure for the Château d'If, he had been put on board the vessel destined to convey him thither. Still, Dantès could not view without a shudder the approach of a gendarme who accompanied the officers deputed to demand his bill of health ere the yacht was permitted to hold communication with the shore. But with that perfect self-possession he had acquired during his acquaintance with Faria, Dantès coolly presented an English passport he had obtained from Leghorn, and with that prompt attention which all such English documents receive, he was informed there existed no obstacle to his immediate debarkation. The first object that attracted the attention of Dantès as he landed on the Canabiere was one of the crew belonging to the Pharaon. Edmund hailed the appearance of this man, who had served under himself, as a sure test of the safe and perfect change time had worked in his own appearance. Going straight towards him, he commenced a variety of questions on different subjects, carefully watching the man's countenance as he did so. But not a word or look implied his having the slightest idea of ever having seen before the individual with whom he was then conversing. Giving the sailor a piece of money in return for his civility, Dantès proceeded onwards. But ere he had gone many steps, he heard the man loudly calling him to stop. Dantès instantly turned to meet him. "I beg your pardon, sir," said the honest fellow in almost breathless haste, "but I believe you made a mistake. You intended to give me a 2-franc piece, and see, you gave me a double Napoleon." "Thank you, my good friend. I see that I made a trifling mistake, as you say, but by way of rewarding your honest spirit, I give you another double Napoleon, that you may drink to my health, and be able to ask your messmates to join you." So extreme was the surprise of the sailor that he was unable even to thank Edmund, whose receding figure he continued to gaze after in speechless astonishment. At length, when Dantès had wholly disappeared, he drew a deep breath, and with another look at his gold, he returned to the quay, saying to himself, "Ah, that's one of them nabob gentlemen from Injy, no doubt. Nobody else could afford to chuck gold about like that. Well, he said I was to drink to his health, and so I will, with all my heart." Dantès, meanwhile, continued his route. Each step he trod oppressed his heart with fresh emotion. His first and most indelible recollections were there. Not a tree, not a street that he passed, but seemed filled with dear and cherished reminiscences. And thus he proceeded onwards, till he arrived at the end of Rue de Noailles, whence a full view of the Allée des Meilleurs was obtained. At this spot, so pregnant with fond and filial remembrances, his heart beat almost to bursting, his knees tottered under him, a misty vapour floated over his sight, and had he not clung for support to one of the trees, he would inevitably have fallen to the ground and been crushed beneath the many vehicles continually passing there. Recovering himself, however, he wiped the perspiration from his brows, and stopped not again till he found himself at the door of the house in which his father had lived. The nasturtiums and other plants which his parent had delighted to train before his window had all disappeared from the upper part of the house. Leaning against a tree, he remained long gazing on those windows, at which the busy hand of the active old man might be daily seen training and arranging his floral treasures. But Edmund remembered he had come thither for other reasons than to indulge a grief now, alas, unavailing. And stifling the deep sigh that rose to his lips, he advanced to the door and inquired whether there were any chambers to be let in the house. Though answered in the negative, he begged so earnestly to be permitted to visit those on the 5th floor that, in despite of the concierge's oft-repeated assurance of their being occupied, Dantès succeeded in inducing the man to go up to the present possessors of these coveted rooms and ask permission for a gentleman to be allowed to look at them. The tenants of the humble lodging, once the scene of all Dantès' early joys, consisted of a young couple who had been scarcely married a week, and the sight of a wedded happiness he was doomed never to experience drove a bitter pang through his heart. Nothing in the 2 small chambers forming the apartments remained as it had been in the time of the elder Dantès. The very paper was different, while the articles of antiquated furniture with which the rooms had been filled in Edmund's time had all disappeared. The 4 walls alone remained as he had left them. The bed belonging to the present occupants was placed as the former owner of the chamber had been accustomed to have his, and spite of his efforts to prevent it, the eyes of Edmund were suffused in tears as he reflected that on that spot his beloved parent had expired, vainly calling for his son. The young couple gazed with astonishment at the sight of their visitor's emotion, and wondered to see the large tears silently chase each other down his otherwise stern and immovable features. but they felt the sacredness of his grief and kindly refrained from questioning him as to its cause, while with instinctive delicacy they left him to indulge his sorrow alone. When he withdrew from the scene of his painful recollections, they both accompanied him downstairs, reiterating their hope that he would come again whenever he pleased, and assuring him their poor dwelling should ever be open to him. As Edmund passed the door of similar rooms on the fourth floor, he paused to inquire whether Caderousse the tailor still dwelt there, but he received for reply that the individual in question had got into difficulties, and at the present time kept a small inn on the route from Bellegarde to Beaucaire. Having obtained the address of the person to whom the house in the Allée des Meilleurs belonged, Dantès next proceeded thither, and, under the name of Lord Wilmore, the same appellation as that contained in his passport, purchased the small dwelling for the sum of 25,000 francs, at least 10,000 more than it was worth. But had its owner asked 10 times the sum he did, it would unhesitatingly have been given. The very same day, the occupants of the apartments on the fifth floor of the house, now the property of Dantès, were duly informed by the notary who had arranged the necessary transfer of deeds, etc., that the new landlord gave them their choice of any of the rooms in the house without the least augmentation of rent, upon condition of their giving instant possession of the two small chambers they at present inhabited. This strange event served to find food for wonder and curiosity in the neighbourhood of the Allée des Meilleurs, and a multitude of various conjectures were afloat as to the probable cause of the house being so suddenly and mysteriously disposed of. But each surmise seemed to wander farther and farther from the real truth. But that which raised public astonishment to a climax and set all speculations at defiance was the circumstance of the same stranger who had in the morning visited the Allée des Meilleurs being seen in the evening walking in the little village of the Catalans, and afterwards observed to enter a poor fisherman's hut and to pass more than an hour in inquiring after persons who had either been dead or gone away for more than 15 or 16 years. But on the following day, the family from whom all these particulars had been asked received a handsome present, consisting of an entirely new fishing boat with a full supply of excellent nets. The delighted recipients of these munificent gifts would gladly have poured out their thanks to their generous benefactor, but they had seen him, upon quitting the hut, merely give some orders to a sailor, and then, springing lightly on horseback, quit Marseille by the Port d'Aix. 26. The Inn of Pont-du-Gard. Such of my readers as have made a pedestrian excursion to the south of France may perchance have noticed, midway between the town of Beaucaire and the village of Bellegarde, a small roadside inn, from the front of which hung, creaking and flapping in the wind, a sheet of tin covered with a caricature resemblance of the Pont du Gard. This modern place of entertainment stood on the left-hand side of the grand route, turning its back upon the Rhone. It also boasted of what in Languedoc is styled a garden, consisting of a small plot of ground, a full view of which might be obtained from a door immediately opposite the grand portal by which travellers were ushered in to partake of the hospitality of mine host of the Pont du Gard. This plaisance or garden, scorched up beneath the ardent sun of a latitude of 30 degrees, permitted nothing to thrive or scarcely live in its arid soil. A few dingy olives and stunted fig trees struggled hard for existence, but their withered, dusty foliage abundantly proved how unequal was the conflict. Between these sickly shrubs grew a scanty supply of garlic, tomatoes, and eschalots, while, lone and solitary like a forgotten sentinel, a tall pine raised its melancholy head in one of the corners of this unattractive spot, and displayed its flexible stem and fan-shaped summit, dried and cracked by the withering influence of the mistral, that scourge of Provence. In the surrounding plain, which more resembled a dusty lake than solid ground, were scattered a few miserable stalks of wheat, the effect, no doubt, of a curious desire on the part of the agriculturalists of the country to see whether such a thing as the raising of grain in those parched regions was practicable. The scanty produce, however, served to accommodate the numerous grasshoppers who followed the unfortunate invader of this bare soil with untiring persecution, resting themselves after their chase upon the stunted specimens of horticulture while they filled the ear with their sharp, shrill cry. For nearly the last 8 years, the small tavern we have just been describing had been kept by a man and his wife with 2 servants. One, a strong, sturdy wench, answering to the name of Trinette, officiated in the capacity of chambermaid, while the other, a shock-headed country lad named Paco, undertook the management of the outer-door work, and contented himself with the title of garçon de curie, or ostler, as we should style it in England. But, alas, the occupation of each domestic was but nominal, for a canal recently made between Beaucaire and Aigues-Mortes had proved a most successful speculation, and had transferred the mode of sending merchandise and luggage from the heavy wagons to the towed barge, while travellers forsook the diligence to glide over the smooth waters by the more agreeable aid of the steamboat. And as though to add to the daily misery which this prosperous canal inflicted on the unfortunate innkeeper, whose utter ruin it was fast accomplishing, it was situated not 100 steps from the forsaken inn, of which we have given so faithful a description. The innkeeper himself was a man of from 40 to 45 years of age, tall, strong, and bony, a perfect specimen of the natives of those southern latitudes. He had the dark, sparkling, and deep-set eye, curved nose, and teeth white as those of a carnivorous animal. His hair, which, spite of the light touch time had as yet left on it, seemed as though it refused to assume any other colour than its own, was like his beard, which he wore under his chin, thick and curly, and but slightly mingled with a few silvery threads. His naturally murky complexion had assumed a still further shade of brown from the habit the unfortunate man had acquired of stationing himself from early morn till latest eve at the threshold of his door, in eager hope that some traveller, either equestrian or pedestrian, might bless his eyes and give him the delight of once more seeing a guest enter his doors. But his patience and his expectations were alike useless. Yet there he stood, day after day, exposed to the meridional rays of a burning sun, with no other protection for his head than a red handkerchief twisted around it, after the manner of the Spanish muleteers. This anxious, careworn innkeeper was no other than our old acquaintance Caderousse. His wife, on the contrary, whose maiden name had been Madeleine Radel, was pale, meagre, and sickly-looking. Born in the neighbourhood of Arles, she had shared in the beauty for which its females are proverbial, but that beauty had gradually withered beneath the devastating influence of one of those slow fevers so prevalent in the vicinity of the waters of Aigues-Mortes and the marshes of Camargue. She remained nearly always in her chamber, situated on the first floor, sitting shivering in her chair or extended languid and feeble on her bed, while her husband kept his daily watch at the door, a duty he performed with so much the greater willingness as it saved him the necessity of listening to the endless plaints and murmurs of his helpmate, who never saw him without breaking out into bitter invectives against fate and the unmerited hardships she was called upon to endure, to all of which her husband would calmly return an unvarying reply, couched in these philosophic words: "Cease to grieve about it, La Carconte. It is God's pleasure that you should suffer, and, whether you like it or not, you must bear it." The sobriquet of La Carconte had been bestowed on Madeleine Radel from the circumstance of her having been born in a village so called, situated between Salon and Lambès, and as a custom existed among the inhabitants of that part of France where Caderousse lived of styling every person by some particular and distinctive appellation, Her husband had bestowed on her the name of La Carconte, in place of her sweet and euphonious name of Madeleine, which, in all probability, his rude, guttural language would not have enabled him to pronounce. Still, let it not be supposed that, amid this affected resignation to the will of Providence, the unfortunate innkeeper did not writhe under the double misery of seeing the hateful canal carry off alike his customers and profits, and the daily implication of his peevish partner's murmurs and lamentations. Like other dwellers of the South, he was a man of sober habits and moderate desires, but fond of external show, vain and addicted to display. During the days of his prosperity, not a fête, festivity, or ceremonial took place without himself and wife being among the spectators. He dressed in the picturesque costume worn upon grand occasions by the inhabitants of the south of France, bearing equal resemblance to the style adopted both by the Catalans and Andalusians, while La Carconte displayed the charming fashion prevalent among the females of Arles, a mode of attire borrowed equally from Greece and Arabia. But by degrees, watch chains, necklaces, many-coloured scarfs, embroidered bodices, velvet vests, elegantly worked stockings, striped gaiters and silver buckles for the shoes, all disappeared, and Gaspard Caderousse, unable to appear abroad in his pristine splendour, had given up any further participation in these pomps and vanities, both for himself or wife, although a bitter feeling of envious discontent filled his mind as the sound of mirth and merry music from the joyous revellers reached even the miserable hostelry to which he still clung, more for the shelter than the profit it afforded. On the present day, Caderousse was, as usual, at his place of observation before the door, his eyes glancing listlessly from a piece of closely shaven grass, on which some fowls were industriously, though fruitlessly, endeavouring to turn up some grain or insect suited to their palate, to the deserted road, the two extremities of which pointed respectively north and south, when he was roused from his daily speculations as to the possibility of the tavern of the Pont du Gard ever again being called upon to exercise its hospitable capabilities to any chance visitant, by the shrill voice of his wife summoning him to her presence with all speed, murmuring at the disagreeable interruption to his not very agreeable thoughts, he, however, proceeded to the floor in which was situated the chamber of his better half, taking care, however, preparatory to so doing, to set the entrance door wide open that, in the event of that rara avis, a traveller passing by, it should be made perfectly clear to his comprehension that no ceremony was requisite in entering. At the moment Caderousse quitted his sentry-like watch before the door, the road on which he so eagerly strained his sight was void and lonely as a desert at midday. There it lay stretched out, one interminable line of dust and sand, with its sides bordered by tall, meagre trees, altogether presenting so uninviting an appearance that no one in his senses could have imagined that any traveller, at liberty to regulate his hours for journeying, would choose to expose himself to the scorching heat of a meridian sun in such a formidable Sahara. Nevertheless, had Caderousse but retained his post a few minutes longer, he might have caught a dim outline of something approaching from the direction of Bellegarde. As the moving object drew nearer, he would easily have perceived it consisted of a man and horse, between whom the kindest and most amiable understanding appeared to exist. The horse was of Hungarian breed, and ambled along with that easy pace peculiar to that race of animals. His rider was a priest, dressed in black and wearing a three-cornered hat, and, spite of the ardent rays of a noonday sun, the pair came on at a tolerably smart trot. Having arrived before the Pont du Gard, the horse stopped, but whether for his own pleasure or that of his rider would have been difficult to say. However that might have been, the measure appeared reciprocally agreeable, since no demur was observable in either. The priest, dismounting, led his steed by the bridle in search of some place to which he could secure him. Availing himself of a handle that projected from a half-fallen door, he tied the animal safely, patted him kindly, and, having drawn a red cotton handkerchief from his pocket, wiped away the perspiration that streamed from his brow. Then, advancing to the door, struck thrice with the end of his iron-shod stick. At this unusual sound, a huge black dog came rushing to meet the daring assailant of his ordinarily tranquil abode, snarling and displaying his sharp, white teeth with a determined hostility that abundantly proved how little he was accustomed to society. At that moment, a heavy footstep was heard descending the wooden staircase that led from the upper floor, and with many bows and courteous smiles, mine host of the Pont du Gard welcomed the blessing heaven had sent him in the shape of a weary traveller, while retreating into the house with backward step, he besought his guest would honour him by entering also.
"You are welcome, sir, most welcome," repeated the astonished Caderousse in his blandest tones. "Now then, Margontin," cried he, speaking to the dog, "will you be quiet? Pray, don't heed him, sir. He only barks, he never bites. I make no doubt a glass of good wine would be acceptable this dreadfully hot day."
Then, perceiving for the first time the description of traveller he had to entertain, Caderousse hastily exclaimed,
"A thousand pardons, your reverence. I really did not observe whom I had the honour to receive under my poor roof. What would you please to have, Monsieur l'Abbé? What refreshment can I offer you? All I have is at your service."
The priest gazed on the individual addressing him with a long and searching gaze. There even seemed like a disposition on his part to court a similar scrutiny on the part of the innkeeper. Then, remarking in the countenance of the latter no other expression than extreme surprise at his own want of attention to an inquiry so courteously worded, he deemed it as well to terminate this dumb show, and therefore said, speaking with a strong Italian accent, "You are, I presume, Monsieur Caderousse?"
"Your reverence is quite correct," answered the host, even more surprised at the question than he had been by the silence which had prefaced it. "I am Gaspar Caderousse, at your service."
"Gaspar Caderousse," rejoined the priest. "Yes, that agrees both with the baptismal appellation and surname of the individual I allude to. You formerly lived, I believe, in the Allée des Meilleurs, on the fourth floor of a small house situated there?"
"I did."
"Where you followed the business of a tailor?"
"True, I was a tailor, till the trade fell off so as not to afford me a living. Then it is so very hot at Marseille that really I could bear it no longer, and it is my idea that all the respectable inhabitants will be obliged to follow my example and quit it. But talking of heat, is there nothing I can offer you by way of refreshment?"
"Yes. Let me have a bottle of your best wine, and then, with your permission, we will resume our conversation from where we left off."
"As you please, Monsieur l'Abbé," said Caderousse,
who, anxious not to lose the present opportunity of finding a customer for one of the few bottles of Vin de Cahors still remaining in his possession, hastily raised a trapdoor in the floor of the apartment they were in, which served both as parlour and kitchen. Upon his issuing forth from his subterranean retreat at the expiration of 5 minutes, he found the abbé seated on a species of stool, leaning his elbow on a table, while Margontin, whose animosity seemed appeased by the traveller having pronounced the unusual command for refreshments, had crept up to him and had established himself very comfortably between his knees, his long, skinny neck resting on his lap, while his dim eye was fixed earnestly on the traveller's face. "Are you quite alone?" inquired the guest, as Caderousse placed before him the bottle of wine and a glass.
"Quite alone," replied the man, "or, at least, all but so, Monsieur l'Abbé, for my poor wife, who is the only person in the house besides myself, is laid up with illness and unable to render me the least assistance, poor thing."
"You are married, then?" said the priest with a species of interest, glancing round as he spoke at the scanty style of the accommodations and humble fittings-up of the apartment.
"Aha, Monsieur l'Abbé," said Caderousse with a sigh, "it is easy to perceive I am not a rich man. But in this world a man does not thrive the better for being honest."
The Abbé fixed on him a searching, penetrating glance.
"I can certainly say that much for myself," repeated the innkeeper, fairly sustaining the scrutiny of the Abbé's gaze. "I can boast with truth of being an honest man. And," continued he, significantly shaking his head, "that is more than everyone can say nowadays."
"So much the better for you, if what you assert be true," said the Abbé, "for I am firmly persuaded that sooner or later the good will be rewarded and the wicked punished."
"Such words as those belong to your profession, Monsieur l'Abbé," answered Caderousse, "and you do well to repeat them. But," added he with a bitter expression of countenance, "you cannot make people believe them in opposition to what passes before them every day when the reverse takes place, and it is the wicked man who prospers and the honest deserving man who suffers."
"You are wrong to speak thus," said the Abbé, "and perhaps I may in my own person be able to prove to you how completely you are in error in coming to so mischievous and dangerous a conclusion."
"What mean you?" inquired Caderousse, with a look of surprise.
"In the first place, it is requisite I should be satisfied you are the person I am in search of."
"What proofs do you require?"
"Did you, in the year 1814 or 1815, know anything of a young sailor named Edmond Dantès?"
"Did I? I should think I did. Poor dear Edmond."
"Why, Edmond Dantès and myself were intimate friends," exclaimed Caderousse, whose countenance assumed an almost purple hue as he caught the penetrating gaze of the Abbé fixed on him, while the clear, calm eye of the questioner seemed to cover him with confusion. "You remind me," said the priest, "that the young man concerning whom I asked you was said to bear the name of Edmond."
"Said to bear the name?" repeated Caderousse, becoming excited and eager. "Why, he was so called as truly as I myself bore the appellation of Gaspard Caderousse. But, Monsieur l'Abbé, tell me, I pray, what has become of poor Edmond? Did you know him? Is he alive and at liberty? Is he prosperous and happy?"
"He died a more wretched, hopeless, heartbroken prisoner than the felons who pay the penalty of their crimes at the galleys of Toulon." A deadly paleness succeeded the deep suffusion which had before spread itself over the countenance of Caderousse, who turned away, but not so much so as to prevent the priest's observing him wiping away the tears from his eyes with a corner of the red handkerchief twisted round his head.
"Poor fellow! Poor fellow!" murmured Caderousse. "Well, there, Monsieur l'Abbé, is another proof that good people are never rewarded on this earth, and that none but the wicked prosper."
"Oh," continued Caderousse, speaking in the highly coloured language of the South, "the world grows worse and worse. Why does not God, if he really hates the wicked as he is said to do, send down brimstone and fire and consume them altogether?" "You speak as though you had loved this young Dantès," observed the Abbé, without taking any notice of his companion's vehemence.
"And so I did," replied Caderousse, "though once, I confess, I envied him his good fortune. But I swear to you, Monsieur l'Abbé, I swear to you by everything a man holds dear, I have since then deeply and sincerely lamented his unhappy fate."
There was a brief silence, during which the fixed, searching eye of the Abbé was employed in scrutinizing the agitated features of the innkeeper.
"You knew the poor lad, then?" continued Caderousse.
"Nay, I was merely called to see him when on his dying bed, that I might administer to him the consolations of religion."
"And of what did he die?
asked Caderousse in a choking voice. "Of what think you do young and strong men die in prison, when they have scarcely numbered their 30th year, unless it be of the horrors of that prison, which has spread its stony walls against their breathing the air of heaven, or participating in the secret affections a gracious Creator permitted to find growth within the human breast? Edmond Dantès died in prison of sorrow and a broken heart." Caderousse wiped away the large drops of perspiration that gathered on his brow. "But the strangest part of the story is," resumed the abbé, "that Dantès, even in his dying moments, swore by his crucified Redeemer that he was utterly ignorant of the cause of his imprisonment." "And so he was," murmured Caderousse. "How should he have been otherwise? Ah, Monsieur l'Abbé, the poor fellow told you the truth. And for that reason he besought me to try and clear up a mystery he had never been able to penetrate, and to clear his memory, should any foul spot or stain have fallen on it." And here the look of the abbé, becoming more and more fixed, seemed to rest with ill-concealed satisfaction on the gloomy depression which seemed rapidly spreading over the countenance of Caderousse. "A rich Englishman," continued the abbé, "who had been his